Vicki Langford with Project 3810. We are a business incubator here in West OKC, and our mission is to help people become better bosses. Project Boss is our special op to accomplish our mission. Bosses have to manage the business from sales to operations to finances. Bosses need to develop their leadership styles and effectiveness in order to achieve results. And our boss members participate in peer coaching through boss board meetups and boss board roundtable. We expose our bosses to subject matter experts and introduce them to key players to help them achieve their business goals.
So today we're going to be discussing how an EMOD affects your insurance policy. It's not going to be an EMOD class, but we're going to go over some basic safety principles that companies can implement in order to save money on their insurance policies and programs. So I'm sure you are wondering, who is this guy? So I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. I am originally from East Texas, but I just moved back there from Oklahoma City. I was up here for about 12 years. So this is actually like coming home for me because I consider this more home than there. Funny story. But family wise, I have a wife and four kids. I have two boys and two girls ranging from 22 all the way down to 15. That 15-year-old thinks she runs me. All right. How long have I been doing this, and how did I get into safety and risk management? So I'll answer this one at the same time. I kind of got into safety and risk management, not kind of, I did, in the oil and gas industry. So I started out working oil and gas, and if any of you guys are familiar with that, that is a very, very rough industry. You work a lot of long hours, and the section I was in was very dangerous. I dealt with explosives all day, and I can remember, I tell people this story all the time, is I had a supervisor who came to me one day. We're doing like 90 hours a week. And he said, DeMarcus, I hired you guys for your back. And when that's gone, I'm going to get the next guy. And I thought to myself, wow, that's pretty rough. And it made me think about a saying my mother has. She would always say, don't nobody love me like I love me. And from that moment on, I can remember feeling on the inside that if I didn't care about my own safety and my well-being, how could I expect somebody else to? And also these people that I worked around all the time, I needed to care about the well-being of them. So that kind of got me on the track of safety and risk management. And I've been doing it for over a decade now. So kind of jumping back into the topic, we're going to talk about an EMOD, what it means for you. And that's just an abbreviation for the term experience modifier. So please remember that if you're a business owner out there and business owners have insurance policies, you need to be familiar with that term experience modifier. We're going to talk about how it can affect your business. We're going to touch on why managing your mod or your EMOD with safety actually matters. And then we're going to really get into the meat of it and talk about some basic safety techniques that accomplishes that goal of managing your EMOD or assisting in management of your EMOD. And then we'll talk about a few industry best practices and hopefully have some time for questions. All right. So what is an EMOD? Basically, it's a tool that underwriters use. That tool is used to determine how much they're going to charge you for your insurance premiums. Again, it's a tool used to determine your pricing. How much are you going to be paying at the end of the day? So if you notice this second one, I'm actually reading it word for word. So you're assigned an EMOD for prediction whether an employer is likely to develop a loss experience that is better or worse than that of the average risk in a particular classification. That's a lot of verbiage, but I'm going to break it down here in a minute real simple. But that's really, really important. So what you need to know and remember is that insurance cost is spread between a lot of other businesses. And depending on what type of business you're in, you are put in a pool with people who do the same or similar type of work as you. All right. So when we look at this or we think about this in practical terms, we're comparing apples to apples. But here's the trick. Here's the trick to it. That underwriter who's determining that price may prefer a red apple over that delicious green Granny Smith apple. It's our job as professionals to help guide you to the apple that is more of the choice of the underwriter. Okay? So we use a specific formula to calculate the mod. And if you see my little disclaimer there, this isn't a full-on EMOD class. All right? I'm going to give you guys like a 30,000-foot flyover. EMOD classes, we can go and talk for hours and hours. But We're going to talk about expected losses versus actual losses. Remember, I said you're in a group, right? So if you're in a group, they say, oh, we expect this amount of losses to occur in the group that you're in. All right. And then you actually have losses that you're going to incur. And hopefully, if you're good, you don't have any losses. But some people do. So if your actual loss is more than expected, your mod will be over 1.0. All right. One is like even. You're even playing field with everybody else in your industry. If you have losses that are less than expected, your mod is under that 1.0. OK, so a mod of one, again, is average. Anything above that, you're over the expected losses. Anything under that, you're under the expected losses. Question you want to tell yourself is, how much better do you want to be? Do you want to be average? Or do you want to be better than everybody else? Everybody loves a little competition, right? Okay. We're going to see why it's important. So let's take that example that I just gave you about apples to apples. We got Joe's Electric and we got John's Electric. They both do the exact same thing. Okay, but for some reason, Joe's Electric over here may be more cost friendly to their business than John's Electric based on some safety practices that they have in place to prevent claims. All right. So everybody ready for the secret?
Yes.
Show me the money. That's what it amounts to. Everybody is in business for what?
Make profit.
We want to do the things we enjoy, but at the end of the day, if we don't make profit, what happens to the business?
Failure.
Business no more, right? So here's an example. This is the exact thing that we just discussed. This is a rough estimate with round numbers to show you how an EMI works. So say a company's manual premium is $100,000, and we're going to work with that number. We already talked about the one being what? I like to ask questions to make sure y'all keeping up with me. All right. So the one is average. The lowest you could ever achieve on a mod is a 0.78. That means 0.22 is controllable. And you may think to yourself, 0.22, well, that's nothing. Well, let's put some math to it. So example one has a debit mod. That means that their mod is over one. Let's say that mod is 1.25. So for every $100,000 they have in manual premium, they're actually playing $125,000 for it. You see where I'm going with this? Now we're going to contrast that to example two. They got the same amount in premiums, but they're doing something special behind the scenes, so they're not having claims. And their mod comes up as a 0.80, which means for the same amount of manual premium, they're paying $80,000. Now, we talked about this 0.22 being controllable. When we look at that, that's $45,000 that they're able to keep in their pocket. Who wants to keep that 45 grand? Because if you don't, you can give it to me. I'll tell you right now, I'll take it in a heartbeat. All right. So starting to make sense. And now if you're a large business and these manual premiums can climb higher than that, and I've seen it, that can equate a lot of money that's going out the door needlessly.
Is there a max on your EMOD above? Like there's a minimum?
I've seen some. The highest one I've seen today, I think, was like a 1.8 something.
At what point do you just get dropped?
You can get dropped. It depends on the appetite of the carrier that you're with. So it's a luck game. But that's a great question. So here's how it affects your businesses. So maybe you're a company that works for different contractors. Nowadays, especially in construction, we're seeing contractors have their subcontractors turn in their EMOD. And this is run every 3 years. The reason why they want to see that, because it gives them a snapshot of the risk that that subcontractor is going to be to them in order to do business. So it's very important. So another thing is, in addition to paying more, you could actually lose out on potential revenue simply because you don't have an EMOD that's at the standard of the contractor you're wanting to work for. So the more preferred that company becomes, the higher the possibility becomes for profit, because these contractors are able to look at them and say, okay, I want to do business with Joe's Electric because they're a lot lower risk than John's Electric. So here's an old saying that I thought was very important when I was putting this together. It says the best way to minimize the hidden costs of workplace injuries and related insurance costs is to prevent accidents from happening in the first place. So this came from the Insurance Information Institute. But when I was putting this on this presentation, I thought about it. It's a simple type of principle that we are all familiar with. Anybody and everybody has been a child before. And you've probably hurt yourself. And the first thing your mom said to you when you was playing on that wall or whatever where you fell and scraped your knee was, you shouldn't have been up there in the first place. Right? So it's a real simple principle that applies here. So also, workers' compensation claims, they revolve around the safety in the workplace. When you go and look at the claims that's associated with workers' compensation, and you see that there's a lot of them, that's a key indicator that something's going on in that workplace environment that's leading to that. And chances are that organization or company or business doesn't have good safety principles or processes implemented. All right. Although worker comp insurance will pay for medical costs and employees' lost income, your business has to absorb the cost from reduced productivity. So you lose a person out of your pool that's working for you, you just lost productivity. If you replace that person, it costs you to train them and get them up to speed. You could also lose costs based on your reputation. Companies may look at you as a non-reputable company and not want to do business with you. So it pays for you to have these practices implemented, not just from the money side of things, but the continuity of your business as a whole. And then also think about the people that you employ. A lot of your employees will feel better about showing up and going to work if they know that, hey, I'm not going to go in today and lose half my arm. Right? It boosts your company morale. If you notice this top bulletin point, and I'm not going to read them all in order, but I always start here because we get picked on as safety professionals. I remember being a director for a company and the guy told me, oh, you safety guys, y'all just take revenue from the bottom line. But as you'll see when we go through this, as we go through this presentation, it's actually possible to save revenue off the bottom line. But OSHA website, this is my OSHA plug, right? They have a deal called Safety Pays. You can go on there and see how much an injury will cost your organization. I encourage everybody to take a peek at that. Now, I'm going to jump down here. When you use that, it's important to know that it's just a snapshot. They don't have all your information of how much your profit margin is and things like, or what your loss leaders are. So that's a relative number, but on average, it kind of gives you an idea to where you can gauge, oh, if we have an injury, this is what it costs us to make up for it. I encourage you to show this to people like supervisors, if you're in construction, superintendents, managers, because they need to know why it's important for them not to have people who are getting injured. All right, so does everybody kind of understand why managing your mind is important? All right, we're all in business to do what? Make money.
Make
a profit. And using these safety techniques is what's going to help you continue to make profit. And at the very least, not take from your profit. Right? At the very minimum, you don't want to take from your profit. Now, the thing about safety is, it's not rocket science. I'm going to talk about basic blocking and tackling. You can use this in warehouse jobs, manufacturing, construction, oil and gas, office settings, anywhere, some of these principles will apply, okay? So the first thing to do is set policies. If you do not have a policy, nobody knows what's expected of them, what the company's expectations are, and what grounds they stand on. But the biggest thing is make sure they're practical, right? You don't necessarily have to do what your competitor is doing, but all you have to do is meet the minimum OSHA requirement and make sure it's practical. And the best way to make sure something is practical is to involve the very people who are doing the job. Because they're going to tell you what's going to work and what's not going to work. So policy, talk to your supervisors, talk to your frontline workers, and then make sure that you have some accountability tied to it. If you don't do that, all you're doing is giving bona fide lip service that's written down. And we got to move past that phase. If you have a fleet, if you're doing any type of delivery services or if you have people who drive company vehicles, whether they're going to see clients, whether they're making some type of delivery to and from the home office, you're going to scale the process. It's all going to be the same. Nothing's going to be reinvented. You're going to develop policies that are practical, that apply to the setting that you're in. So if you're in Oklahoma City, your driving policy should look different, or your fleet policy should look different from somebody in Minot, North Dakota. Main reason being is what?
Snow.
Snow. Different driving conditions, right? So address what's going on in your area. Yeah, population density. That's a really, real good one. That's the first time somebody's ever brought that up, and that's a real good one. Because the higher the traffic, the higher the risk. There you go. Talk to those supervisors and frontline workers and let them choose what they want to be responsible for. Because think about it like this. Say you and I are working together, and I come and tell you, hey, I need you to do this job. Chances are you may do it if I'm your supervisor. But if you come up with a task that's relevant to the safety policy that you want to do, that you're passionate about, what's the chances you're going to keep doing it?
100%.
Yeah, because it's your idea now. You get to own it. All right? And again, we're going to have accountability tied to it. Why? There you go. I ask questions a lot. You gotta have that accountability. So look at this note. Most companies we see that have the highest vehicle claims are due to non-existent or poor driving programs. I can't tell you how many driving programs I've done in the past 6 months, but I know it's over 10. And some of these companies are large. That's a simple oversight that can be addressed. Okay? So subcontractors, if you are using subcontractors in any capacity, make sure A, they meet your standards, and that they have some their own standards that they're adhering to that meets some form of what's required of their business, okay? Develop that policy that's reflective of your standard, pass it on to them, make sure they have one, and communicate. Communicate with policies, with companies about the work that's being done. I just watched the other day on a YouTube from the CSB, the Chemical Safety Board. There was some confined space work that was happening on these two tanks. They were side by side, but at the top, they connected together with a pipe. And the companies who were doing the work, they were subcontractors, they looked at it as two separate tasks. This company was over here doing their thing, and this company was over here doing their thing. They didn't communicate. They didn't talk about the confined space entry. Long story short, one of the companies was using some type of heating device to heat the inside of the tank where they were applying a highly flammable adhesive material. It fell in a bucket, caught on fire. They jumped out and ran. Those two survived. But it filled up and all the smoke went into the other one and engulfed the other tank, and those two people died. And they had no idea what the guys in the other tank was doing. Mm. Got to communicate what's going on. So training. Everybody kind of frowns at training. Sometimes it can become monotonous. We keep doing training over and over and over again. Rule number one is your training should always be as creative and innovative as possible. Think about the audience that you're delivering the training to. Some people like to be spoken to like this because I have a heavenly voice. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Others like hands-on. They want to get out, they want to touch, and they want to feel the items that they're dealing with. And then you have some that may not have a lot of time on their hands, so web-based interactive training may be the better approach. But rule number one is make sure you're aware of the audience that you're talking to. So after you do that, give them training that relates to their job. That's all OSHA requires. A lot of times I'll go into a business and I'll see companies giving out all these trainings, and maybe 30% of them don't even apply to the workers and what they're doing. All you're doing is forcing somebody to do something that they don't even have a need to be doing. So the stuff that they do need to do, they have a sour taste in their mouth. So you're shooting yourself in the foot. If you're doing training, provide training in a language that's understandable by everybody in the audience. If you have some of the audience that speaks a first language that's different than English, you must, according to OSHA regulations, give them that training in the language that they understand better. Have to. Okay? Document it. So I'm a son of a Marine. And my dad used to have a saying, and I think he stole it from somebody who stole it from somebody. If it ain't in writing, it didn't happen. It's as simple as that. If it ain't in writing, it didn't happen. So document it. The trainer, the topic, the participants signed the roster, and you dated. Okay? Companies have a duty to their employees to know what type of trainings they need to be put through for doing their task. And all you have to do is a needs assessment to figure that out. And in most cases, when you're looking at risk management and you're talking to your insurance carrier or your broker who has a risk consultant, they should be able to come out and help guide you through that. So this is kind of continuing on training, all right? So not all trainings are equal. Sometimes you'll have trainings that you'll do for onboarding or a one and done. Sometimes you'll have trainings that you have to repeat. If you have a forklift in your facility, that's a training that you have to repeat every 3 years. If you have people who are trained in first aid and CPR, that's a training that you have to repeat every 2 years. I've seen companies do trainings and repeat them, or they say they're good for 5 years. You know, it's a little inside joke, but it happens. So if that training has to be repeated, make sure it's done on the right schedule and make sure it's done in the right manner. For forklift, as an example, they have to do a written, a practical, and then a hands-on demonstration to be certified. And then you have other trainings that can actually boost your or make you more appealable to the contractors you're working for. We see this a lot in construction. So say you want to go work for a large GC and you're a subcontractor, and Joe's Electric and John's Electric, we'll use them too as the same example. Joe, he goes out and he gets his employees trained in OSHA 10s and 30s, and that GC says, oh man, that company really cares about their employees, we're going to give them the project because they may be a lower what?
Risk.
Because now they've gone the extra mile. In addition to giving them the required trainings, they're doing something that's beyond what's required of them maybe. Now, some general contractors may require that you do that, but some don't. But doing that shows that you really take it serious, and it makes you less likely to have a claim on a project. Anybody have equipment, deal with any type of equipment? So sometimes we'll go in, and you can even bring this down to something that you may not think could injure somebody, but it could be a cost or a claim. Maybe you have a lot of studio equipment, and the way it's being stored can not only injure somebody when grabbing it, but it makes it difficult to maneuver. So now something's getting broken, and you have a piece of equipment that cost you $10,000, $20,000 that you don't want to come out of the pocket for, but it could have just been stored differently. Or maybe you are dealing with a lot of high value or heavy mechanized equipment like backhoes, track hoes, and different things like that. Make sure that that's managed properly, that equipment being worked on is worked on by somebody who knows what they're doing, not just John who likes to work on his cars on the weekend because he seems pretty good at it, all right? Make sure when you do maintenance and repairs, you document it, because I'll tell you this, if you have somebody get injured, chances are somebody's gonna wanna see some documentation on repairs and maintenance on that piece of equipment, okay? It's unrecommended to rent equipment for subcontractors. I actually went through this with OSHA. I was in a situation where a company rented some equipment for a subcontractor, let said subcontractor use it, and that subcontractor's employees got injured. Who else do you think was tied up in that with the subcontractor?
The person that rented it.
The person that rented it. Because they rented it, and they did not verify that whoever was using it was competent to use the equipment. So now that became a liability or risk to them based on that one action. And audits. Nobody likes to go through audits, but I'm gonna tell you what, you gotta do it. Because you can't expect what you don't inspect. And I'll say it again, you can't expect what you don't inspect. We can talk about all these risk management practices and safety principles all day long, but if we don't verify that it's being done, what's the use? So if you're putting something in place, you want to know, hey, does this expectation carry out or carry on to the job site? Are the employees actually doing it? Okay. Do we at any time do we come up with new technologies and better ways to do stuff?
Every day.
every day. So if you never go back and look at said policy, you could be living in the past and doing something that's outdated or wrong, or there may be an easier way to do it. And then how else are you going to know about other job site hazards that you could possibly be facing if you don't engage the employees, if you don't talk to them? Because how we draft up something on the paper may not always translate to what it looks like in actuality when you get out to the work site. I've seen it 100 times. All right. The number one reason I say the best for last why we do audits is most times I can go out and look at somebody's organization and there is a person there that wants to be safe. There is a person that wants to do a good job and they're proud about the company that they work for. I always call them like my foot soldier, and I love finding a foot soldier because now I tap into that person because that person's on the front line in the field. And who do you think can influence that person more? Me sitting behind a desk or the person they're working side by side with? Yeah, that's simple, right? So find out who that advocate for your business is. And the best way to do that is by asking questions, doing these audits, because you get to know what a person's thinking, right? Another thing that's good is it shows your employees you have a commitment to safety. It shows contractors you have a commitment to safety. Those contractors and clients you're trying to work for, if they see you interacting and engaging your people in that manner, they're going to say, oh, I want to keep doing business with this company because I'm comfortable. I know what their expectations are. I know what they're going to do. And in the event that you do have a mishap or a claim, chances are they may be a lot more lenient with you because they know you're putting forth an effort, as opposed to somebody who says, oh, I just hope it goes good. Right? Yeah. So create that sense of trust with the people that you do business with. Create that sense of trust with the employees that you have working within your business, because they're flying your banner, so to speak. They're flying the flag for you. So another good one is ergonomics. So if you're in an office setting, this kind of gets overlooked, but a large amount of our worker comp claims are what we call MSDs, musculoskeletal disorders, that person that's sitting at the computer typing all day. And the reason why those are so pivotal is because they become long-term injuries. So those stay on your EMOD for years sometimes, because that person has to go back to the doctor and make all these visits. So that claim can't close a claim. And when you can't close a claim, all it's doing is just dinging that mod more and more. And here's the deal. We've come so far with technology and the way that we approach things and our stepping, handling, and lifting techniques, we should be able to reduce a lot of these claims from happening. And in addition to that, we should be able to engineer out some of these claims. I tell you what, we could fill this room with boxes and stack them on the floor and have people come in day in and day out, picking up those boxes. Now I'm at a chance of a leg sprain. I'm at a chance for a back sprain, a back strain, shoulder, arm, hands, anything. And I can reduce significantly the chances of somebody being injured by stacking the boxes on the table. Now, normal business owner may say, well, that's going to cost me too much money. Now you're telling me I got to go buy tables so I can stack stuff on that so no one has to bend over. Yeah, you want to pay a $100,000 medical bill? Bet you it's cheaper than those tables. More efficient. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to stop looking at the tree and we want to see the forest. Again, it's not rocket science. You want to make sure your risk consultant, your insurance carrier, they should be asking you these questions. They should be coming into your business, assessing it, looking at how the work is being done and saying, hey, did you ever think about this? So let's say someone gets injured. They get injured in your business. They're out. What are you going to do? Well, if you don't have a return to work program, it's going to cost you a lot. Because you're paying for that person to be off. You're paying for that person's medical visits. The point that I'm trying to make here is by using safety practices and having a return to work program and assessing what you're doing, you should have a plan to get that person back to work as quick as possible, doing something that is beneficial to the company. And there's a lot of ways to accomplish that goal. but you have to have a return to work program. The main thing is it's going to decrease your medical costs. Also, it's going to eliminate unnecessary claim cases being left open. Okay? And if you're doing it the right way by having a return to work program and having someone walk you through that process, you can also guard against unnecessary medical treatment. There's a lot of clinics that they make money by your employees continually being serviced by them. So you have to do your due diligence to make sure that first the medical attention is right, because we do care about our employees, let me say that. We want them to get the right medical attention, but we don't want them to get medical attention that's not needed to where, again, claims are being left open and we have these high medical costs. All right. A lot of companies, they use medical management personnel. There's a lot of companies that have in-house that helps aid with this. I know we're one of those that do that. So be mindful of that. Okay. Also, again, you want to show that your employees that you care about them. So it's going to increase their confidence in you because you're saying, hey, are you getting the right medical attention? Do you need this? Do you need that? Let's make sure we get you back to as close to 100% as we can. All right, this is my favorite part. This is for the employees. Incentive programs. Now, before I get into it, and I'm going to say this twice, there's a right and a wrong way to do incentive programs if you're implementing it in your safety program. All right. So one study found that companies with a safety incentive program experienced a 44.16% reduction in lost time workday injury between 99 and 2001. On the other hand, another company found that without a safety incentive program, they had a 41.84 increase in the lost time. So it's just kind of showing you the value of it through two different examples. Okay. A report found that 75% of U.S. manufacturers utilize safety incentive programs that may impinge on workers' safety reporting. So that's one that's important. Basically, again, there's a right and a wrong way to do an incentive program. We do not reward people for not getting injured. Don't do that, because all that means is they're going to hide the injury from you. And here's what's going to happen. They're going to hide that injury from you, and they're going to hide that injury until it becomes so bad that they got to come and say something. And now a claim that could have been managed in the beginning has now exacerbated and become this huge thing that it may not have ever gotten to because that person was keeping it from the proper people that need to know. Right and the wrong way to do it. All right. So, and I've seen incentive programs work phenomenally. I was at a large oil and gas service company, the largest one in the world. They had a great incentive program. And you'd be surprised, in our division alone, we spent about $500 and it reduced our claims in the tens of thousands that we were seeing. And we didn't pay people to not get injured. There's a certain way to do it. All right. So, again, you have this situation where you're looking at the tree and not the forest, because somebody may say, I don't want to spend $500 on my employees to reward them. But that, if that $500, if I told you, hey, I can save you $45,000 for $500, raise your hand if you're turning that down. Nobody in their right mind's doing that. So, again, safe behaviors should be rewarded. You see somebody doing something safe, you reward them. Because here's the Jedi mind trick. That person's going to get rewarded for acting safe. They're going to go off to their buddy that they work with and say, hey, man, I just got this $5 Starbucks coffee card because they saw me doing something the right way. And that buddy who likes Starbucks, too, what do you think they're going to do?
Do the same thing.
They're going to display the same behavior, right? Finding hazards should be rewarded. Remember, I told you I love foot soldiers. Somebody finds a hazard that you didn't even know existed in your company, they might have saved you a $30,000 claim. You mean to tell me you can't give them 10 bucks? Mm-hmm. When you talk about it in that term, it doesn't make sense, right? So again, not getting hurt should not be rewarded. Here's the question. Would you spend 240 bucks to save $20,000?
Sure.
You don't have to be a math genius to do that. So again, here's some ideas. Gift cards. Social gatherings. Somebody told me the best way to a man's heart is through his stomach. I like to eat food. So a lot of people like to eat food. Time off, recognition, leaderboards. Employees love competition. If you have fleet companies, I've seen them do it a lot. Johnny drove 10,000 miles without an accident. And then James comes in and like, I'm gonna drive 15,000 miles without an accident. So there's a lot of ways to get creative with doing this. So here's the advice I'm gonna leave you all with. Safety principles and practices, they can affect your EMOD to a relative degree that can save your company money. The choice is whether we're gonna use them or not. Again, we gotta stop looking at the tree and see the forest. So hopefully you guys are having these conversations with your carriers and your risk consultants that work for your insurance company. Because as we get back in the swing of our economy and we get back to doing businesses, companies want to stay in business, and the only way we can do that is by remaining profitable. And we have to look at every avenue of our business where we can remain profitable, even our insurance policy. Okay? And that's why we manage risk. Communicate with similar industries. Find out what somebody in your industry is doing that may be working really well and do that. Try it out. You know, you never know if you don't try. Newsletters, you can subscribe to them. There's a lot of information out there. I subscribe to ASSP. I subscribe to risk management. I subscribe to OSHA. Now, not everything is relevant, but when I do find that one thing that is the value on it is priceless in a lot of instances. So I encourage you all to do the same thing. Any questions? Go ahead.
If I ask my insurance people what my EMOD is, will they tell me?
Yes, they should. Okay. But yeah. Yeah, you should know, every business owner should know what their EMOD is, because it's a 3-year tally. It's talking about how you did for the past 3 years. So they should tell you that. They should actually be discussing that with you.
What's an annual premium?
That's basically the cost of, I'll put it in terms of workers' compensation. So workers' compensation is you pay X amount of dollars for insurance per employee. Now, that dollar you're paying for insurance, or whatever that, I'm just using a dollar as a generic term or generic value, that can change depending on what they're doing. And here's why. You may have 10 office employees who sit at an office all day, and you may have 10 employees who do excavation and trenching work. Yeah. What's more dangerous? So that one may cost you $3 per employee versus your office personnel costing you $1 per employee, because the risk is higher for your excavation worker. So after they find out how many employees you got, what job role they have, they tally that up and they say, here's your manual premium, here's what it's gonna cost you for that.
Where's the place the most common place you find the breakdown between top leadership understanding the need for safety processes and implementation, and then actually being executed or not executed at a production level?
Okay, I'm gonna repeat that. I should have been repeating these questions. You said, what's the most common place that I see the breakdown, and I'm gonna try to shorten it, with top level leadership understanding the need for safety practices, in a nutshell?
In both directions, really. Understanding what's happening on the floor and people on the floor putting into practice what leadership asked of them.
Okay, so people on the floor and leadership understanding, both directions. Okay, people on the floor, I think the breakdown is that they receive conflicting messages. I think that a lot of times, remember I said that if we just put something in writing and we don't have any accountability, it's just bona fide lip service, just in writing. So in some instances, I think companies can fall into that trap to where now their employees are receiving conflicting messages, because production is so pushed in companies, and production is important. But at the same time, if somebody gets injured, you just shot all your production in the foot, right? And so in that employee's mind, it's like, yeah, you guys are talking about safety, but you're hounding on us so much for production, and I don't want to lose my job. I'm in fear that if I don't meet this quota, something's going to happen to me. I may not get a bonus or something. And so that's where the breakdown happens. With leadership, the most common thing I see is I think there's this competition to look the best, and I think you lose some of the... the what I would say genuine aspect of wanting to be a good company, and now you're just competing with other people. You're like, oh, well, they got this safety award, and they start just throwing out all these things that they want to do. Well, we're going to do everything that Joe's Electric is doing. And maybe their company is not as big as Joe's Electric. And what they really need to do is hone in on what's practical instead of just doing what's boilerplate, I would say. And the boilerplate is easy, though, right? Because that boilerplate is information you can just grab off the internet. To really go in and assess your workplace, that's going to take some work. That's going to take you some time for you to really sit down and think about, okay, I know these are the requirements I got to meet, but how do I meet them and make them fit my organization, not just throw on what somebody else is doing? Any more questions?
I just have a question. What's an OSHA 10 and 30?
So an OSHA 10 and 30 is like a bundle of information that covers the common hazards you would see on the workplace. Now, of course, the OSHA 10 by the number is shorter than the OSHA 30. So it talks about falls. That's the number one killer of construction workers. It talks about being caught in between something. It talks about being crushed by items. It basically goes over certain principles of safety that companies need to apply by in order to keep their workers safe. And to add to that, you have a general industry OSHA 10 and 30, and you have a construction OSHA 10 and 30. So your general industry would be companies like warehouses, the manufacturing places, and then your construction sites, of course, would fall under the construction. And oil and gas would be general industry too. Any more? Well, I appreciate everybody's time. This was fun for me. I want to say a special thank you to Vicky for having me. So this was like coming home for me to be able to come and talk to you guys and speak to you about safety principles and how they affect your EMOD. If you ever need to reach out to me for any questions, I have some cards and stuff there on the back. So thank you guys again.
Thank you.